It's 24 and a half minutes after the hour. It is a Tuesday morning, and of course, that means a visit from Dr. Don Clark. Don, a biochemist, a member of the Board of Creation Moments. A couple of stories we'd like to address with folks this morning. One, and this is special for me in a strange way. It's an Institute for Creation Research article. It was published in August of 2022, so it's not a new story, but they have found fossil footprints in Utah. And of course, the debate is how old are those footprints and how they... To me, footprints, ancient footprints, are much more interesting than, say, dinosaur bones being uncovered. I mean, this is almost like a greeting from the past. It's a message. There's something very human about this, and it touches me.
Well, they're human footprints, so it should be human, and there's no doubt about that. They're actually human, and they think it happened during the wet part of the glacial period here. And so these footprints in Utah, the salt flats of Utah, that they're found, I mean, they're called ghost tracks because you can only see them after rainfall, and where, you know, they appear from the rock and from the, I guess it's sandstone or something that the footprints are on. And they found, using ground-penetrating radar, they found up to 88, you know, footprints in the area. And this is not the only area where they found footprints. There's footprints in White Sands National Park, for example, and in Australia, in Canada, in South Africa, in Chile, in Saudi Arabia. And these footprints happen because apparently these people, after the flood, I mean, we, you know, creationists would say, okay, the glacial period happened after the flood, which would have been 4,500 years ago, as opposed to tens of thousands of years ago, which the evolutionists folks say. We would date that much not as far back as that. But the footprints would have formed in areas that today are arid. And so you say, okay, well, how could the footprints have formed in an arid condition? And the answer to that is it wasn't arid back then. And there was a lot of rain after the flood. And because of the Mid-Atlantic Rift and all of the volcanic activity and the underwater volcanic activity, the waters were warmer after the flood, during the flood, than they are now. And guess what warm water does for you? Well, if you heat water up, even if it's not to boiling, you're going to get more evaporation with warmer water than you're going to get with colder waters. And so if you have more evaporation, the evaporation's got to go somewhere. And it comes down in the form of rain or snow, depending on where you are. And so the footprints, then they think that these folks in the salt flats, for example, were walking around in, you know, maybe a couple of inches of water. And so as they stepped, their footprints would be covered over by sand, but their footprint would be left in the clay or the sediment, the soft sediment, that would be under the water there.
So they were apparently walking on shallow water. And the significance of that is that helps us age the footprints, right?
Well, it helps us age the footprints, but it also says that, for example, in Saudi Arabia or the Sahara Desert, that those areas were once wet and not dry like we have today. If you even go back to the time of Abraham, for example, when he was walking around, you know, and Israel is arid, and the Middle East is arid, but it wasn't always the case. The Middle East was lush and damp, and when Joshua, for example, and Caleb and the 10 other spies that went in, you know, Joshua and Caleb came back and to report that, hey, the land is flowing with milk and honey, and look at the size of these grapes. And they had huge cluster of grapes that they had to carry on in a big pole, and two people carry them because they were so large and so heavy. So the area wasn't arid like we think about today, but it was actually wetter because of this condition of the oceans being warmer than they are today. And then, of course, over periods of time, hundreds of years, even, you know, thousands of years now, the oceans have settled down and have cooled down. And so now we don't have the rainfall that we had back then. And so you got different conditions now. And the evolutionists like to use, let's look at the present, and then we'll predict what the past was based on what the present is. You know, that doesn't really work, especially in a condition like this, where there was a catastrophe. Of course, the evolutionists don't believe in the catastrophe that is recorded in the Bible, in the Genesis record, for example. There was a global catastrophe called a worldwide flood, and that then would have changed the conditions around the earth dramatically, and it did, because it killed off all the land creatures, for example, on the face of the earth. But we often don't necessarily think about the aftermath after the flood. One of the aftermaths, of course, is that, the oceans were warmer, they were pumping out water, and that actually, between that and the increase in volcanic activity during and for a period of time after the flood, would have precipitated, I hate to, use a pun there, precipitated the ice age and all of these wetlands, which are now arid, where we can find these footprints.
So we're talking about a time period of, 600, 700, 800 years after the actual flood, where conditions were still radically different than we see now.
Yes, exactly. And so you got to, this is, of course, Utah's in America. So these are the Americas that we're talking about, where people walked around. And that was after the flood. And of course, we know that everybody got wiped out except for the eight that was in the ark after the flood. So there was a lot of multiplication going on, not only of animals, but of humans. And, of course, we know that some humans migrated from essentially the Middle East towards, Asia, what we now call Asia, and then across the Bering Strait, which was a land bridge, at the time. It wasn't covered over by water, but it was a actual land bridge where people could cross. And then they migrated into Americas. And then, we have, of course, the Eskimos, and then the Native, what we call Native Americans, all part of this migration that took place probably 400 or 500.
Okay, I've got a strange question for you then. Is it not possible that these footprints were created before the flood?
Well, no. And the reason for that is because these are sediments that were created during the flood, and the footprints would have been completely wiped out by the catastrophe of the flood.
So what was the nature of the atmosphere, the climate, pre-flood?
Pre-flood, after God created man, he proclaimed that the conditions were very good, and that term for very good actually means perfect. So the conditions were perfect for life. God set up the garden where he put, obviously, Adam, and then later made Eve, and then there was the wilderness outside of that, but the conditions, you recall our discussion about Genesis, that the moisture it hadn't rained till the flood, so the moisture actually came up as mist in the morning that watered the land. So folks didn't even understand when Noah, for example, got the message from God, hey, you need to warn these people that I'm going to wipe out the earth with a flood. And so he was building the ark, and people would come by, and he would proclaim, "You got to, you know, come join us on the ark. We got plenty of room." And they scoffed at him because they thought he was crazy. It's they didn't even know what rain was, water falling from the sky. The conditions were much more perfect for life on Earth before the flood than after the flood.
Now, you've said before you suspected that the climate pre-flood was uniform from pole to pole, north to south.
Well, you had it more uniform than certainly it is now. And then, as you recall, before the flood, there was this one landmass called Pangaea. We now call it Pangaea, where geologists say, it looks like all these continents kind of fit together into one landmass. And indeed, they do fit together in one landmass. And if you analyze the Earth, for example, on both sides of the Atlantic Ocean, you find out that, this is the same composition as over there. And so it's now pretty well recognized that before the flood, there was, at least at some point in history, there was one landmass. And that landmass was in the region of the Earth that is more temperate than as the continents drifted apart and then the poles, drifted apart, the Arctic and the Antarctic, for example, got to regions which were much more colder now than they were back then. And this is borne out by studies of both the poles and saying, hey, this must have been warmer at some point in time.
Now, you're describing the view of a creationist. The article also mentions uniformitarian scientists. And it says that both creationists and uniformitarian scientists agree that the tracks were made during the Ice Age, but they disagree as to when the Ice Age occurred. What's a uniformitarian scientist, and is it the same as an evolutionist?
Yes, basically. I mean, they basically say that what we see today has always been, and nothing has changed, and so we take what we learn today. For example, erosion of the earth, erosion of a mountain, for example, or erosion caused by a river or a stream, that rate has always been the same as it is today. And so if you have that type of thinking, then in order to carve the Grand Canyon out of the Colorado River, that's going to take a long time, if indeed it's possible. With the little trickle of the Colorado River that's going through there, now. And so it just doesn't explain a lot of things. But there's people that still hold on to that view that, hey, we just have to look at what we see today and look back and say that's how the conditions were back then.
That means they don't have to look out of the box, huh?
They don't have to look out of the box, and they certainly don't want to look into the history book that we have, which is called the Bible, and to see, what happened in the past, because that might give us some clues and then might change our mind about these things, and especially about the Ice Ages. I mean, the Ice Age is best described by the creation model, and there was one Ice Age. While there might have been different periods of cold and warm periods due to the amount of volcanic activity that was going on, but for an ice age to even happen or to occur, you need two conditions. One, you need a lot of water. And the only way you get water in the atmosphere is by warming up the oceans. And that's what we think happened during the breakup of the landmass.
The fountains of the deep. I mean, that's the explanation for the water during the flood, not rainfall, right?
Oh, for the increase in water on the face of the earth, yes. But for the water being warmer after the flood, you have to get the cauldrons of the earth heating up the water, which you would have had if your land masses are breaking up. And now you're exposing more of the magma, for example, to areas where there's water, where it wasn't exposed before.
Now, which is interesting, because we've discussed this a couple of times. Recent discoveries have revealed that there is more water under the earth, deep down, encased in minerals, than there is on the surface of the earth in all the oceans and rivers and lakes in the world. So this idea that the fountains of the deep could have erupted through the breaking up landmass is doesn't sound far fetched at all.
Well, no, that part is not, and of course the Bible, you know, supports that. And all of the caves that we have, they're not filled with water anymore, but the caves are evidence that, hey, this was filled with water at one point in time. And that's why they, you know, they appear the way they do. And so you needed, not only did you need the water in order to cover the earth with water, but you needed the warmer water to pump more moisture into the atmosphere. And that's the point. In order to have more snow, and in this case, more snow and rain, you have to get more water into the atmosphere. And the only way you're going to do that is if the oceans are warmed up, as opposed to staying at the same temperature. So as the oceans were warmed up, more moisture got into the atmosphere. The volcanic activity, which is the next step in forming an ice age, the increase in volcanic activity pumped up a lot of dust into the upper atmosphere, blocking the sun, which then made it cooler in certain regions of the earth and allowing the moisture in the atmosphere to precipitate and to precipitate as snow and to pack down as snow. But as the volcanic activity waxed and waned, if you will, you would have periods where it warmed up a little bit and then periods where it got colder a little bit. And so if you're looking back in time and saying, oh, this looked like we've had many, many different little ice ages in the past, because there seems to be a rhythm to this, you could get the wrong impression by the evidence that you see in these ice layers, for example, that have darker regions and lighter regions in the ice cores, that could be easily explained as increase in volcanic activity for the darker areas and decrease in volcanic activity for the lighter areas. And hence, the creation model then explains the ice age, and there is only one ice age, and that was after the flood, and there's not going to be another ice age. Now, we're going to have periods of warming and cooling, as we've talked about before, because the sun goes through periods of more solar activity and periods of less solar activity. And guess what heats up the earth more than anything else? It's the sun.
The sun, so, yeah. Well, I accept all this. This is all fascinating stuff, but I can't help it. And call me a romantic if you must. But I look at this picture of two footprints, and it's apparently... there's nothing to tell me the size, but I'm thinking it's about a size 12, and the person is standing feet together, probably marveling at what's around him. To me, this is a calling card from the distant past, and I'm touched by it. I mean, I'd like to hang that picture on my wall. I'm gonna put a link to this ICR article in our chat window at brokenroadradio.com if you'd like. And it's a short article if you're interested. Just looking at the picture, it'd make a great greeting card, I think. There's another topic that we've talked about here recently, and that is electric vehicles, and it's related because climate change has somehow made us think that we need to dump fossil fuels and move to other wind and solar and the like. And it looks like the first great movement in that direction is about to fall flat, huh?
Oh, it is. And that's with regard to EV electric vehicles. And, you know, there obviously the government was pushing hard and strong. Certain governments were pushing hard and strong for EV electric vehicles. And but the electric vehicle isn't new. And this article that you pulled up at the Cornwall Alliance, you know, shows an advertisement by for the Bailey Electric Victoria Phaeton, which was an electric car by Edison Storage, and it got an Edison Storage battery in it. And it sold for $2,400 to $2,600. And this advertisement was from 1911. So EV is not new. It's been around for a long time. And it didn't really catch on for two main reasons, which plague the electric vehicles even today. And those two things were the distance that one of these vehicles can or cannot go, mainly cannot go. You know, they're short distance vehicles. And two, the expense. The only people that seem to be buying or have bought EV vehicles are the upper echelon of society, or those in the first and second tier of the economic spectrum. The poor folks can't afford these things, and hence they don't get the government tax credits that are available, or were available. I don't know if they still are. They probably are. If you buy an EV vehicle, and then we'll give you a tax credit because you bought an EV vehicle to offset part of the cost, increased cost of these vehicles. So consequently, I think people are catching on that, one, the vehicle's not very practical, has never been practical. Even back in 1911 or even before that time, they just weren't practical. And then the internal combustion engine came along and just kind of wiped out that particular market back then. And guess what? We still have internal combustion engines, and they're still, we like what the internal combustion engine does. That is, gets us to where we want to go.
It's interesting that they refer to those as ICEs. Now, we've been saying EVs to mean electric vehicles. Now I'm seeing the term ICE, I-C-E, internal combustion
yeah,
engine.
And we were just talking about ICE.
Yeah, yeah. What a coincidence. Interesting stuff in this ad, this 1911 ad. I'll read part of it because it's the fine print here. And it's talking about the Edison storage battery in this automobile. It powers the automobile. The automobile is called the Bailey Electric, and it has the Edison storage battery. It runs the Bailey 150 miles under good conditions and 100 miles under any conditions. It's arranged to satisfy every need. That might have been the case in 1911. You didn't have to go far.
Yeah. And it looked like a horseless carriage because it was fashioned after the horseless carriage. And then, of course, an internal combustion engine was put into that. And then away we go with those type of vehicles. But the other thing that is happening is that people have stopped buying these things, or at least not in the number that they were. So we have Tesla's stock right now is in free fall, and their greatest rival, I guess it's Rivian, has lost $1.5 billion in value over the last couple of years. And other companies are going bankrupt that are in this business, and they're looking for like a second round of the financing in order to keep them afloat. Apple has pulled out. They made an announcement, I think it was a couple of months ago, maybe it was a little bit longer, but they're pulling out of the EV project because people know that, hey, these things aren't convenient, and they actually are more polluting than the internal combustion engine. And one of the reasons why they're more polluting is because they burn up your rubber tires faster because they're so heavy. So
that's a major component in air pollution that seldom gets mentioned. You think of CO2 and things like that, but it's tire dust, which is a huge
problem. It's tire dust, and which has a worse effect on your body than, carbon dioxide is, like I said before, is plant food. So we're exchanging plant food for tire dust, and that's just the start of it, not to mention, as we've talked about in other programs, the disruption or destruction of the environment due to digging up these heavy metals and rare earth metals that you need in order to make the batteries. And then you got to dispose of the batteries once they're all used up. Another environmental issue.
That brings up another economic issue as well, as people are now discovering, because they've been buying EVs from Tesla and elsewhere for a couple of years now. In fact, the government has funded fleets of buses to cities to run electric-powered buses, and they're discovering they don't work, and they break down. And they're discovering now that the resale value of an EV is rock bottom. I mean, you can pay $70,000 for a new one in 3 or 4 years. That battery needs replacing to the cost of $12,000, $13,000, $14,000. So how do you sell a used EV with lots of money? Who's going to buy it?
Yeah, you don't. I mean, that's you don't. So you're stuck with it. So it's not a good investment for the person who's looking for a reliable form of transportation. It doesn't get you as far. And then, you know, we've heard the horror stories of this past winter, for example, of all these EV vehicles that were stranded because it's so cold that the batteries don't work anymore. And so you're basically in the middle of the road with stranded vehicles.
And the chargers are unable to recharge the vehicles. So a lot of problems. I mean, the EV may come in time. The idea is now we tried to force it beyond the capability of the technology and without considering all the factors.
Oh, boy.
So you rush stuff to market, and things like that happen. Don is a member of the board of Creation Moments, their website, creationmoments.com. And you can visit there and discover a wealth of information, scientific information, about the biblical story of creation. It will help inform your discussions, your conversations with people around the water cooler, and you'll be able to explain all this stuff to people. So take a look. Visit the website, creationmoments.com. You can link there from ours at brokenroadradio.com. Don, take care. We'll see you in a week or so.
See you on the 9th.
Yeah, okay.
Ready.